Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Now that we're in the midst of another mega wildfire season, we're still feeling the impacts of last year's unprecedented season of fire intensity, the like of which we have rarely seen. How do we cope with this new reality of climate chaos-induced wildfires, and have we learned any lessons from last summer? To help us navigate this maze, today we talk with Dominic Della Sala. Dominic is a forest ecologist with Wild Heritage in Southern Oregon. He had to evacuate from his home when the Alameda Fire ripped through Talent, Oregon last summer. Dominic, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Yeah, hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me on your show again. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, I think the last time that we talked, we were in the middle of fire season. It seems like this is becoming a deja vu. The other day, I was walking along the bluff in Selwood at sunset, watching this rather disturbing sunset. It was not just your ordinary gorgeous smoke sunset. It was this really weird thing where the sun was just kind of fizzling into a cloud of smoke. And I ran into a woman who was watching the sunset on the bluff, and I mentioned how bizarre it was, and she said, "Yes, this looks like everything that we've been doing wrong." And that really resonated with me as like looking, I mean, I think in the last week, we're really seeing the outcomes of every mistake that we've been making over the last probably 200 years. So what your thoughts, Dominic, as we are facing another fire season, and I know that you're much more in the thick of the smoke than we've been here.
Yeah, that is such a powerful observation. And as a climate change scientist, I spend a lot of time looking at the projections going forward in time. If we continue to put emissions into the atmosphere and destroy our forests, it's going to get even worse. And it's really hard to communicate the sense of urgency of what it means to be in a code red, as recently determined by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and its latest findings, that we have so little time to really turn things around. And so I think, you know, illustrative messages like, wow, you know, it looks different than when I grew up in this area, and the sunsets are different, and there's not as much snow in the wintertime on the mountains. I mean, all of these changes are happening around us. They're happening in what seems to be an insidious manner, because we don't pay attention to them necessarily until recently. Now they're becoming much more of our daily conversations, as we are now, by my count, in our fifth heat dome of the summer. And every time we get these heat domes, people suffer, people die, and a lot of folks don't have air conditioning or proper housing. So it's affecting the disadvantaged, the elderly, the poor, more so than any other elements of our society right now. And we need to pay attention to this, as we are indeed in a code red.
Well, on the other hand, after several nights of very weird sunsets, last night I took a walk along the bluff again with my new puppy. I ran into the same woman, actually, and her husband. And the sky, it was a beautiful sunset. It was like a classic late summer Oregon sunset. The sky was blue and the clouds were the right colors of pink. And I just wonder, when we move out of the bizarre conditions that we were in just a few days ago back to what appears to be normal, how do we get people to remember what they had just experienced and realize that what we're seeing now that we think is normal is so fragile?
Yeah, I think that's really the big dilemma that we face. I mean, look at it from the standpoint of the COVID-19 pandemic that we're in now. We know how to avoid people getting ill. You wear a mask in public and you get vaccinated. And yet we've got, what, about 30% of the population refusing to do that, spreading the disease around and not paying attention to the science. So I look at that as an example of, this is something that affects everyone and we're not getting it right yet. How the heck are we going to get it right on climate change, especially when things can seem to return to normal? But I think you have to keep this perspective in mind, that if we continue to be on the path that we are now, with putting unprecedented amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, treating our atmosphere as a dump for our emissions, we're going to see a lot more of these heat waves. We're not going to just see four or five of them every summer. We're going to see a lot more. For example, we're projecting the climate of Redding, California, which typically gets into triple digits and typically sees droughts, is extending northward into Portland and beyond. And so you know, we're not prepared for this. A lot of people in Portland do not have air conditioning, and a lot of people are not in proper housing. So it's going to have its impacts increasingly, and we're going to see less of those blue skies and more of the kind of funky red sunsets that we've been getting.
Well, you mentioned COVID, and I was thinking about Governor Brown on June 30th having the big celebratory reopening of Oregon and eliminating all the COVID restrictions that we've been having at that point for about 16 months. And at the same time that she was having the celebration, the COVID levels in Oregon were starting to rise. The Delta variant was here. And I know I felt this way, and a lot of other people felt this way. Why are we celebrating an opening when this other new threat is just around the corner? And we are actually, I think there were 99 cases. The average daily rate was 99 cases the day she opened Oregon again. 99 cases is still 99 too many. So I wonder, how do we address that mentality? Because it's not just the like individual 30% of people who refuse to get vaccinations, but it's also our elected officials who seem to be pretty wishy-washy about the whole thing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, it's, as you mentioned, it was not a prudent decision to prematurely announce victory over a pandemic that, again, is heating up. And, you know, to the governor's credit, she has been on top of this for the most part, not so much on the climate issues, and can do better in terms of protecting our forests as carbon sinks. But, I mean, you compare that to what's going on in the southern part of the country right now, where you have governors in Florida, for instance, that are banning masks, that are telling schools that they're not going to get any funding if they require masks in kids, and yet at the same time, kids are winding up in the hospital. So it's the science always seems to lag behind or be dismissed by folks working the policy arena because they're under a lot of pressure to deliver. No one wants to go back into a lockdown. No one wants to wear masks. No one wants to have to deal with funky orange sunsets. But the reality of the situation is if we don't take those precautions, we're going to be pressed with even more difficult decisions going down the road as both the pandemic and the planet heat up.
Well, I want to get back to you mentioned the most recent IPCC report, and I wanted to talk a little bit more in depth about that. I also talked about it last week with my guest Vivek Chandas. But I think I'd like to talk to you about it from the perspective of forests and the role that forests play in controlling the climate. My impression after reading the summary of the report was, I'm so glad they're saying these things, like that it's absolutely irrefutable that human influence is what's driving climate chaos, and there's no question about it anymore. But I also thought, well, didn't we know this like 20, 30 years ago? And why did it take the IPCC so long to be able to make that kind of conclusion?
Yeah, there's politics in everything, right? And scientists always want to have degrees of certainty. And, you know, I agree that that statement about it being unequivocally human caused has been known for quite some time. My new book's coming out, subtitled Speaking Truth to Power. And in it is the foreword written by Dr. James Hansen, which he was one of the first scientists to testify in the U.S. Senate in the early 1980s, saying that if we didn't change the direction, the trajectory of carbon emissions, that within decades, the planet would be facing a crisis. And yet here we are, decades into what his future was at the time. Why did it take the IPCC so long to reach an unequivocal finding in their latest report that this is, you know, what we're seeing is mostly or all now due to human activity? And I had commented that there's politics in everything. And even in the science community, there's politics. And scientists, by nature, are very conservative in reading the tea leaves of the data that we look at in terms of what the planet is doing. But I agree it took us too long to reach that conclusion. It delayed action on the policy side because there was this kind of wishy-washy lack of definitive, unequivocal statements that decision makers took advantage of. I think it's great that the IPCC finally recognizes an unequivocal finding, but it's decades too late.
So what does that mean for us if it's decades too late?
we don't have much time, and we are very close to, or if not, have already crossed some of the tipping points associated with the planet overheating. I think we crossed that with how wildfires are behaving in our region now. They're driven mostly by top-down global climate forcing agents. For instance, extreme fire weather now happens every summer here due to triple-digit temperatures, high winds, and unprecedented droughts. That's what's really giving us these big fires today. You hear that we need to log the forest to stop the fires. That just makes it worse by putting more carbon into the atmosphere, into this deadly feedback loop where we log the forest, carbon goes into the atmosphere from logging that then determines our future fire characteristics.
Well, one of the things that was most stunning and disturbing about the fires last summer were those amazing winds that picked up, and they blew from Vancouver Island, or actually probably the northern tip of Vancouver Island, all the way down to the Mexican border. And I remember talking to a friend in Tacoma the morning of the winds, and he says, "Are you ready for the big east wind?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" "Yeah, we're going to get it, but you don't get east winds in Tacoma." And he said, "Well, it's forecast." So that was one of the things that really drove the fire. And I'm wondering how, I know you're not a meteorologist, but do you think that the kind of winds that happened last summer are something that could happen again? It was something that was like once in a thousand year event. Is that something we should be prepared for to happen, not in the next 1,000 years, but maybe the next 10 years?
Well, yeah, that is absolutely a concern. Now, here's the weird thing. I had a surreal experience during the Alameda fire last September. I was actually writing an opinion piece after reading the tea leaves of, you know, we're at a triple digit temperatures for the last 2 weeks down here in Southern Oregon. We had unprecedented drought and the winds were blowing strongly out of the east. And while I was writing that op-ed, my power went off and I went outside to check my switch box, my power lines, and noticed a plume of black smoke was descending on my community. So climate change arrived at my doorstep that day while I was writing about it, warning people that we were in a major hazard right now because of the risk, because of the way the climate was affecting our region. We're seeing more of this now. One hypothesis is that as a result of a contorted jet stream due to the overheating of the planet, we're seeing more of these weird events, east flowing winds, the polar vortex breaking up and heading over into the northeastern United States, giving them blizzards during the wintertime. I mean, this is a result, a consequence of us overheating the planet and changing these global processes that have been in place for thousands of years, giving us the stable climate that's allowed us to become the societies we are today. All of that is changing now.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic Della Sala, a forest ecologist with Wild Heritage in Southern Oregon, about the new reality of annual mega wildfires we are finding ourselves in and as a result of climate chaos. Well, let's talk about what we can do as we recognize that this is now the new normal means we don't know what it's going to be from day to day, but how do we start to address that? And I actually would like to start with what you were talking about not clear-cutting forests, because one of the key things that's been really controversial since last summer's fires is that the methodology to deal with the repair work after the fires, the mitigation after the fires, is to start clear-cutting all these old-growth trees, many of which are not even dead. So what are the lessons that have not been learned from last summer, and what do we need to learn in order to stave off even worse consequences?
Yeah, so I still have hope. I have grandkids. And so I think, you know, the solution to climate pollution, if you will, is right in front of us. We know how to solve this problem, and we've known how to solve it for many decades now. We have got to transform radically our energy economy. We can no longer be taking fossil fuels out of the ground and treating the atmosphere as a dumping ground. It's going to impact all of us severely if we don't change course. And we know how to do that. There are all kinds of clean, renewable energy sources that need to get to scale in terms of their application. The second thing we need to do is to protect our forests, because they are a big sponge of carbon. And, you know, I've studied old growth and mature ecosystems for over three decades now. And when in my early studies, we were all focused on biodiversity, and then it became water and how much those forests were giving us in terms of what we need. And now it's carbon. That's been the new discovery that has happened over the last 10 years or so. And so by pulling out carbon from the atmosphere, plants, in this case our forest, and especially the old trees, are doing us a major service in helping to keep the planet from getting an even greater temperature. And so we need to do more of that. And then we have to deal with the lag, the hangover effect. If I had a magic wand and said, hey, we've got this new energy source that's not going to pollute us with carbon, and we're off of fossil fuel emissions, it's still going to take centuries before the carbon in the atmosphere reaches the safety line that doesn't tip us into more extreme climate weather conditions. And we don't have that time, so we've got to do this quickly, and we've got to adapt. And what I've done several times, I've testified in the U.S. Congress and in the state legislature, that the money that they're putting into fire remediation is going in the wrong directions. They're putting it into logging, whether it's pre-fire logging or post-fire salvage logging. You're putting more emissions into the atmosphere. We've got to be taking that money and helping communities adapt by building fire-resistant houses, by home hardening, by helping people that still don't have homes because of last year's Labor Day fires find homes in affordable ways that are home hardened, because we're not going to simply snuff out these fires. They're going to be with us for a long time to come, especially as the climate is becoming increasingly severe.
Well, it seems like that different elected officials are going in different directions. Now, am I correct that Oregon actually passed a law in the last session that would maybe move in the direction you're just talking about?
They did, but there's some poison pills in there, too, because a lot of the money is going into backcountry logging. And, you know, just give you an example, the Alameda fire, which affected my town of Talent and nearby Phoenix. We lost, though, about 3,000 structures. That fire went structure to structure in a domino effect. It took out all the mobile home parks. It went through residents with no trees around them. And it was the 40-mile-an-hour east winds that blew it on top of people's roofs, blew out windows, embers got inside. Structure to structure fire. It had nothing to do with the forest. It had nothing to do with the thinning in the Ashland watershed that everyone's putting money into. We were told that that thinning would reduce our smoke over time. We were told that that thinning would save our homes. None of that has happened. If anything, it's gotten worse because the money's being placed too much into backcountry logging. That's not going to solve a problem that's mainly coming from top-down global processes that are overheating the planet.
Actually, I remember you talking last summer about watching that fire, you know, like these explosions that were happening in Talent, and you realized that it was the propane tanks that were blowing up. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because that also becomes a connection with fossil fuel usage and the way that fossil fuels are being stored in low-income communities that make them even more of a fire hazard.
Yeah, we don't design these homes for fire safety. They're built on the cheap. I get that. People need affordable housing, and it's, you know, it's going to be a cost to do this right. But you've got to look at long-term costs and the valuation of the home. I mean, if you're a home buyer and you see two houses that look identical, one has been hardened for fire, the other hasn't, and you're in a fire-prone area and you're a conscientious buyer, and the costs are comparable, maybe the home hardened one is a little bit more costly, that's what you're going to buy. And the insurance companies need to kind of go in the direction now of adjusting their premiums. Give these homeowners a price break that are doing it right, that are hardening their structure, that are building with fire-resistant materials. They are going to see their value shoot up as we see more of this damage occurring to urban areas as wildfires are no longer wildfires. They're urban fires.
Well, I'm thinking about after a lot of the flooding that was endemic, particularly on the coast and on the west slope of the Coast Range, that finally, particularly in Tillamook County, there were building codes, I think, that required that buildings that were built in the floodplain had raised themselves up on stilts, basically. Kind of like what a lot of building, I think the building codes in South Florida are like that now, too. And I'm wondering, so that's what you do to mitigate for a flood. You raise your house up above where the water's going to rise, unless you were really wise and like would relocate outside of the floodplain. But what would be the equivalent that people would do to harden their houses against wildfire?
Yeah, there's a couple of different things that could be done. First of all, if you already have a house, then as you remodel and you look around your house, you need to make sure your gutters are properly screened, all the vents are screened, because all it takes is one ember to enter the house, and all bets are off. If you're remodeling your siding, you don't use wood. You use fire-resistant materials, hardy board. There's, you know, even hempcrete that's out there that could be used as siding that is relatively fire-resistant. If you're building a new house, then the prudent action is to go with non-flammable materials, and wood is the most flammable material that you can put into a structure. That's what mostly burns when the houses go up. And yet what's frustrating to me is I have kind of these mixed feelings. I'm watching my community of talent literally rise out of the ashes and rebuild itself, but at the same time they're doing it with products from Roseburg lumber that came from clear cutting the forest, putting more emissions into the atmosphere, building with fire, flammable materials, wood, and expecting a different outcome. This, to me, is the definition of crazy. We've got to look at alternative structures. For example, building with recycled steel instead of wood and using materials that don't burn the exterior of the house, having a metal roof, screening all the vents. And then we got to look at, maybe we shouldn't be building in some places. Maybe we should be relocating people. We're now seeing towns that have burned down more than once, and we're going to see more of this as the climate gets increasingly weird.
Has Paradise, California been rebuilt in the same place that it was? That burned three years ago, I believe?
They're in the process of rebuilding right over the same fire burn perimeter, and so are we in Talent and Phoenix. So we're rebuilding right over the same burn perimeter using the same structures. Ashland got by without burning this time, even though the fire started in the Ashland community. And I've done some surveys using the space shuttle to map houses in Ashland in terms of their susceptibility to fire. And we could see from the space shuttle their vegetation touching people's roofs. People that have got that have built houses with wood shake roofing material, all of those are prone to a urban catastrophe, and yet all the money is being spent in the backcountry to do thinning, and that's not going to help any of those houses if a fire goes through the Ashland watershed.
Well, actually, a few years ago, it was right after Paradise burned, and I was walking in the woods with a friend of mine. And he was talking about how he was afraid that Portland could be the next Paradise. And I said, I'm not so much afraid of Portland because we're not really on the urban wildland interface. But I'm worried about Ashland. And actually, last summer, I was amazed that Ashland didn't burn because Ashland is of the Southern Oregon communities between Ashland and Medford. Ashland's the only one that's really built in with woods around it. I was really surprised to be hearing that Phoenix and Talent were burning because I didn't remember seeing very many trees when I'd been down there. Why do you think that Ashland survived this time, or last time, and what do you think Ashland should be learning from the experiences of Talent in Phoenix?
You know, had the winds gone a different direction, it would have been a total nightmare in Ashland. And they were fortunate, and the residents of Talent and Phoenix were not. And it was a matter of what direction the winds were blowing, and they were blowing at 40 miles an hour, running through mostly fields of invasive flammable plants like blackberries and star thistle. And once they encountered a structure, then the domino effect happened. And it could have easily happened in the town of Ashland had the wind been blowing in that direction. So they escaped this time, but I worry about it. And, you know, I've had friends that have lost their house. I've grown up in this community, so to speak. Over the last 23 years, I've lived here in businesses that no longer exist. And it's because people are not taking this seriously enough that we've got to build better, safer, affordable housing and not just build over the same area using the same flammable structures and expecting a different outcome.
Well, since Phoenix and Talent are not really what you'd consider in the wildland urban interface, why would you want it? What difference would it make to rebuild in a different place? I mean, is there a safer place to rebuild Talent than where it is right now?
No, I think Talent is fine where it is. You know, I worry about other communities that are just, you know, in more dangerous situations. And I worry mostly about the continued expansion into the so-called wildland urban interface. Decades ago, this was not a big problem. Now we've got millions of houses built in unsafe locations. There's been unmitigated sprawl, places that we should never have built in, and that is still taking place. And we've got to start looking at our land use zoning in terms of whether or not the risk have been properly identified and the buyers are aware of those risks and the insurance companies are aware of those risks. But for Talent and Phoenix, we need to build better structures. And again, you know, just seeing the decks and decks of Roseburg lumber out there taken from our forest, clear cutting, putting more emissions into the atmosphere, building with the same flammable materials is crazy when we know how to do this better. And that's why I testified in the Senate multiple times saying that we've got to start building our communities better, affordable housing, and with fire safety in mind. And one other example I'll give you, this is another concern that I have in Talent. I'm seeing these more expensive structures go up that are not home hardened, and I'm now worried about gentrification. I mean, there was a housing crisis in our region before. It's going to be even more apparent now as the housing costs have shot up in value, and it's going to be pushing people out. So, you know, you could get gentrification even further in Southern Oregon now.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dominic De La Sala, forest ecologist with Wild Heritage in Southern Oregon, and we're talking about the new reality of annual mega wildfires that we're finding ourselves in as a result of climate chaos. When you describe what a hardened house would look like, I think about my sense of aesthetics and a lot of people's sense of aesthetics, and particularly people who move out into the woods who want to live in a house that kind of looks like it blends into the woods. And I'm wondering, how do you overcome that kind of prejudice? And how do you build a house in the woods that fits in, that's made out of non-wood material?
Yeah, you know, I could definitely sympathize with that. In fact, my prior house before I was living in downtown Talent was in the woods. And I actually did defensible space around my house. So we went out there with a group that does this, and we made sure that there was no vegetation touching any structure and that we didn't have anything flammable around the house, that all our vents were screened. The other thing that's really important to do is that in remodeling of these houses, make sure you get windows that are resistant to 70-mile-an-hour wind speeds. Because what we're finding now is through these extreme climate events, we're seeing pyrotornadoes that are developing their own weather systems increasingly as a result of climate chaos. And the windows that are on most houses can't sustain those wind speeds. And once you get an ember inside, it's all bets are off. So I think we could get smarter about this. What I get worried about is, again, the Ashland watershed is primed to burn. A lot of those houses are not hardened. I have friends that I go to their house for dinner. I can't turn around in their driveway because there's such a narrow driveway surrounded by trees. There's no way a fire truck is getting into those driveways, and you're going to lose your house and maybe your life if you don't take these precautions while there's still time.
So how do we get people to appreciate that besides just like talking about it on the radio?
Well, I think we got to see more of the local governments making some tough calls and introducing land use zoning ordinances and requirements for home hardening. And we need elected officials to provide some funding for low-income families to relocate to safe housing, to upgrade their houses for fire resistance and home hardening. We know how to do this. It's just the money's going into the wrong pots because we've got special interests that think the solution is to cause more of the problem by putting more emissions into the atmosphere by logging our forests. That's not where we should be spending our money. Every dollar we put into logging in the backcountry is a dollar that we can't help families that still do not have a place to live down here. A lot of them are migrant workers that are picking our agricultural crops, that are still displaced by the fire that happened last year and can't afford to go back into their homes.
Well, we talked about the bill that passed the Oregon legislature about mitigating fire damage, basically. And you talked about the bad part of it, but are there any good things in that bill, do you think, that move in the direction that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think that there's this emphasis on home hardening, and it's starting to get out there, home hardening, defensible space. But, you know, it's a little too late and a little bit too late in terms of how much money is being put into it. And I would have liked to have seen the vast majority of the money going into home hardening, relocation assistance. And this is what I've told decision makers on numerous occasions, that your money is not being allocated properly. You need to put a bigger pot together for doing what we're talking about here. If we're going to get out of this fix that we're in, at the same time, you need to back off of all the logging that we're seeing, because that's just making matters worse by contributing to the emissions along with fossil fuel burning.
Well, one of the things that's frustrating to me, I mean, I have a few, maybe not heroes in the Oregon Democratic Party, but people that I have a lot of faith in them agreeing with a lot of the concerns that I have, one of them being Jeff Merkley. But I got an email from him a few months ago, and he was talking about a certain wood product. I can't remember the name of it. I think it comes out of Roseburg. And he was talking about how this is the future for jobs in Oregon, and it's sustainable, and the trees that are cut are sustainably cut. And I actually wanted to talk to you about that. Are you familiar with this particular method of this type of wood product that Merkley is promoting?
I believe he's talking about cross-laminated timber.
So what is it, and do you think it helps to solve any of these problems, or do you think it's just making the situation worse?
You know, I have a lot of respect for Senator Merkley and our two senators, but on this issue, we're going to have to beg to differ on how we see the value of forest in terms of the climate emergency. Now, cross-laminated timber, or CLT, is claimed to come from small diameter trees that are engineered to produce greater structural integrity for building. But it's not always small diameter trees. And often there are big trees that are used in CLT as well. And so we have to just kind of keep in mind that every time we take a tree out of the forest or we cut down the forest, a big chunk of that carbon that was in the tree eventually winds up in the atmosphere. So we've got to start looking at our forest differently. Yes, we need wood products, and we can reduce our consumption, recycle, find alternative materials, hemp, a bunch of other products that can be used for manufacturing paper and clothing, et cetera. So we can get to sustainability, but it's not through CLT, and it's not through logging our forest. The only way we get out of this mess is store more carbon in ecosystems and get off of fossil fuels.
I'm just thinking, as you're talking about recycling, there were these two really nice little Victorian cottages on 13th Street in Selwood that were businesses, and they're both gone now and then replaced by four-story structures, which are probably built relatively with fire-resistant material. But I think about all the wood that was in those two cottages that were dated back to probably 1890, when there was a lot of old growth in Oregon. And I wondered what happened to that wood, and I have a feeling that none of it got recycled. And I'm wondering if there are ways to encourage, if we are taking down old homes and old structures in Oregon that are built with this incredible old growth wood that used to be so plentiful here, if there's some kind of way to encourage people to be recycling this material in a more efficient way than happens right now.
Let me give you some numbers so folks can understand how much carbon is lost when we cut down the forest. So if this is an old growth forest, as our example, when that old growth forest is clear cut, 65% or so of the carbon goes into the atmosphere at some point. A lot of slash is left on the ground, and carbon leaks out of the soils now exposed from the logging and goes into the atmosphere. Then you put that tree on the back of a logging truck. Some of those logs are going to be shipped overseas, made into wood products, more emissions from fossil fuels go into the atmosphere, moving the materials around. About 19% of the carbon in that tree or in the forest winds up in a wood product. Most of those wood products are short-lived, like paper. Some of them are longer-lived, like in a building. But over time, the rest are going to wind up in a landfill. And in comparison, if it was an old growth forest, it's in the carbon from the atmosphere is in that forest for centuries. It's in the soil for millennia. And so when I hear all we need to do is store carbon in wood products and buildings, that doesn't take into consideration the old growth trees that were doing it for centuries and how much of that carbon is lost. And so chances are those cottages that you described wound up in a landfill. And within decades, maybe longer, whereas the trees those structures came from lived for centuries and sequestering, absorbing carbon from the atmosphere for centuries. We cannot replace our forest or our trees with wood products that are going to only store a portion of the carbon and only for a short period of time.
But I'm also thinking about these wood products that are, you know, 100 years old. That could be reused. I mean, a piece of wood. I live in a house that's over 100 years old, and there's amazing features in the house that were from old growth forests back in 1907. So it seems to me these are real treasures, and I just wonder if there's a way to encourage people to be looking for that kind of wood as opposed to buying new wood.
I think that's a great idea, and I think that's the real salvage that should occur. It should occur in buildings, not in forests. So we tend to look at our forests after they burn as, hey, you know, the trees are dead. Why not go in there and cut them down anyhow? And they call that salvage logging, which puts more emissions in the atmosphere, destroys the regrowth taking place in that forest, and a lot of really important wildlife habitat. So I think the real salvage should occur in buildings because we knock them down frequently in our cities, in our towns, within decades. And if there's a better way to extract out the wood that's still usable, yeah, that would definitely improve things, put less pressure on our forest to log them, and put less emissions into the atmosphere.
Well, thinking about one of the things that really disturbs me is the first time that I met you, I think it was in 2004, and we were talking about the Biscuit Fire, which was at that point the Biscuit Burn, where there was an awful lot of effort to do post-fire logging. And that's when I learned an awful lot about fire ecology, actually, from you in the first interviews we did. By the time I finished this radio documentary that I was doing at that time, the logging was stopped. The roadless rule that Clinton had put into effect just before he stopped being president was reasserted by federal courts. And so the piece sort of had a happy ending because the area was not going to be logged anymore. However, there was an awful lot of logging that did go on in that 3-year period. And I think now about all the lessons that seem to be being learned in 2007 but are completely forgotten as we're going through the greatest rash of post-fire logging, I think, that the state has ever seen. I wonder what you think about what was learned after the Biscuit Fire and if there's ways to reclaim the knowledge that was gleaned at that time.
Yeah, so that biscuit fire was a teachable moment for me too, Barbara, and it led to one of the books that I co-edited with my colleague, Dr. Chad Hansen, subtitled Nature Scenics. And what we learned through studies all over the world is that when these older forests burn in a fire, like what happened in the Biscuit, they are incredibly biodiverse, as biodiverse as the old growth forest. There's just a different community of plants and insects and wildlife that come in and need those post-disturbance forests. We call them complex early cereal or snag forests. They're incredibly rich in biodiversity and carbon. Most of the carbon remains in the trees. It just goes from the live trees to the dead trees and is there for decades. So we've learned a lot about what has happened after the Biscuit Fire. And from an ecological standpoint, it was a necessary fire, and it was part of the ecology of one of the most biodiverse places on the planet, the Siskiyou Wildlands in Southern Oregon and Northern California. And unfortunately, that message has not translated into the policy arena, because now every time we get a fire, especially a severe fire, there's a rush to log the dead trees, which are the most important part of the forest renewal process. You will not get a forest come back on that site unless you leave the dead trees there to allow the natural processes to occur. You might get a plantation, but it won't be a forest ecosystem.
So what do we do to regain that knowledge? Well, I'm just thinking about what's going on right now along all the rivers where there were burns last summer and the amount of logging that's happening. And there's a whole other issue about how do we stop that, which some people I've talked to think it's kind of hopeless at this point. But do you see a way forward so that we can at least stop the worst excesses of the logging that's happening and really reframe our whole vision of why a burnt forest is such an important ecosystem?
Yeah, this has been probably the biggest challenge of my 30-plus year career and working on fire, because there are human health implications, there's the smoke, there's the fear of fire, there's the perception that the forest was killed instead of it being rejuvenated, which is what we know from the ecology of these burned forests. So I think a lot of it is even in the way we communicate. I see articles from the press all the time, the fire consumed the forest, or the fire was catastrophic. First of all, fires don't consume the forest. Mostly what burns in a fire is the duff layer and the living foliage on the ground, the needles and the leaves of the tree. But the trees are still standing. I mean, go into a severely burned forest, you see all dead trees. They're still there. It wasn't consumed by the fire. It was, burned, but most of the carbon is still in that forest. Only about 10 to 20% of it wound up in the atmosphere. And if we go back and log those forests, then we're putting most of that carbon that's still in the forest up into the atmosphere. And that's just the wrong way to pursue it. So how we get that message in the hands of the public to really recognize that a fire like what happened in the Eagle Creek fire in the Columbia Gorge, that was an ecologically beneficial fire, even though it was catastrophic to the businesses and we had to deal with the smoke, but the ecology of that system was benefited by that fire, and you can see it by flying over or driving through the canyon now. It's doing quite well in places that weren't logged. And so we've got a messaging problem, and then we've got the issue of, because it's not important, as perceived by some, we can just log it. And, you know, a lot of our politicians get their political action contributions from the logging companies.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBFG Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And we're talking today with Dominic Della Sala, forest ecologist with Wild Heritage in Southern Oregon. And we've been talking about the new reality of the annual mega wildfires we're finding ourselves in as a result of climate chaos. I want to get back to what's going on right now down your way, where actually the largest wildfire in Oregon, I was just reading today, the Bootleg Fire that's east of Klamath Falls, has been 100% contained, which doesn't mean it's out. It just means that they have fire lines around it, so it's more controllable. I'm wondering what the view of the smoke and the fire and just the whole gestalt of what's going on is the perspective from Southern Oregon. Up here in Portland, I'm not sure where our smoke came from. I don't think it might have come from there. I think it probably came more from the fires that are west of Bend. But how is it affecting the community, and what kind of discussions are maybe being encouraged by what's happening?
Well, you know, I moved here in Southern Oregon in 1998. I escaped from Washington, D.C. because I hated the climate there, both political and weather-wise. And I moved here because it was such a biodiverse place, and I wanted to get the word out that our region is among the most biodiverse temperate regions in the world. And I've loved my summers up until the last five or so years. And the summers now here are getting intolerable. And I truly believe that if we don't change the path that we're on, portions of the United States and other parts of the globe are going to become not only intolerable, but uninhabitable. Water's drying up in the Southwest. California is in an extreme drought situation. How are we going to sustain our communities as this gets worse? And so while I used to love my summers, now, you know, I hear from people, where can I go for 3 or 4 months out of the year to get out of the smoke? And I tell them, well, you probably can find a refuge somewhere, but you can't run away from climate change. It's happening all over the globe right now, and it's escalating. And so those discussions are underway. I've also heard all kinds of anecdotal evidence that the fire went around places that were thinned, that the Nature Conservancy thinned the Sycan Marsh and the fire went around it and slowed down and got lower in intensity. But there's been mapping by scientists at the Chaparral Institute using Google Earth engines. And what they're finding is the fire sped up in places that had been thinned, had been logged, had cattle grazing over it. What we're seeing from the space shuttle using Google Earth imagery is really going against what advocates of logging are saying, that it slowed down. Well, it actually went faster through these areas that have been clear cut. Logging slash gets left on the ground. The trees are so densely packed from being in a plantation that when you combine that with extreme fire weather, we're seeing these big fire events happening now. That's not being discussed enough. Instead, people are getting desperate. And when we get desperate, we tend to do things that are maladaptive. And I think that's going to increasingly occur unless we could say, hey, you know, wait, stop. This is not helping the situation. And here's why. We've got to do it differently. And we've got to get to coexistence with wildfire, because we're not going to snuff off all of these fires. No matter what the politicians or the Forest Service is telling people, you cannot put out every one of these fire starts. It's impossible. It's unsafe to firefighters, and we're going to see more of it in extreme fire weather. So we've got to get to a different relationship by preparing for these fires, by being smart, getting our homes and people ready for it instead of logging in the backcountry.
I have this image of people who are trying to escape from Afghanistan right now as the Taliban has taken over Kabul. And people, I was reading about people clinging to airplanes as they're starting to take off. And of course, they, once the plane leaves the ground, these people fall off and die. And I kind of feel like that's where we are with climate change. I feel like we're kind of trying to cling to an airplane that's going to get us out of here. So instead of clinging to the airplane, what should we be doing?
We need to build a new plane, a better plane. One that is in sync with Mother Nature, not that one that is constantly in a battle, command and control over wildland, over ecological processes like fire. Fire suppression has become a militarized battle against nature. It's necessary at times to protect towns, but it's coming with immense collateral damages, because we keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different outcome. I have a graph that is one of the papers that I'm working on right now that shows acres burning from the 1980s to current. On the same graph is the amount of money we spend on fire suppression. Both of them are going up at unprecedented amounts of spending. We're spending billions of dollars bulldozing fire lines, throwing chemicals on our forests, cutting down our forests, and putting firefighters in harm's way because of desperate acts. And I don't think that's going to solve our problem. We've got to get smarter about this. We've got to work with nature under some conditions. That means letting some areas burn for ecosystem benefits. It means redesigning our communities to be fire safe. And it means getting off of fossil fuel emissions.
Well, it also seems like we need to be reaching out to our elected officials and helping to change their minds. And I know you, as you've been saying, you've been testifying in front of the U.S. Senate for many, many years. I'm not too sure to what avail. But what can we do with our local elected officials? I mean, you've got a great guy down in your way, Jeff Golden, who I think understands the importance of the role that forests play in climate change and in mitigating for climate change. But who can we turn to, and how can we encourage the elected officials to start changing the laws?
You know, people have asked me before, how do you remain positive, given I work at a global scale and I constantly am using satellite imagery? I could see what's going on to the planet. I read the climate models. I can see where we're headed. How do you not get depressed? And how do you influence the world so that it changes and goes in the right direction, so that we're not causing more suffering to the next generation? And the one thing that gives me hope, and because maybe because I'm a grandparent now, are young people. I really think that our generation, is the generation I grew up in, has missed the boat on this. And so my hope is to reach into young people, to support them, to support the climate activists that are walking out of school, that are protesting, that are striving for a better future. Greta Thunberg is leading that charge, but there's a lot of Gretas around the planet that are doing the same thing. So that gives me hope that through political activism, our decision makers will either come around or be exposed for the way they're treating the planet and then be voted out of office. But we're running out of time. And we need a socially charged movement that is global and local that starts to turn this thing around. Otherwise, we are headed into a severe consequence. You think it's bad now. In 10, 20, 50 years from now, it's going to be a whole lot worse if we don't start to make the changes today.
Well, Dominic, I want to thank you for all the work that you do, and also all the education that you've done for many people, including myself. So thanks for being on Locus Focus, and we'll talk again in a couple months when your book comes out.
Yeah, thanks. Great having you on your show again, Barbara. Take care.
We've been talking with Dominic Della Sala with Wild Heritage in Southern Oregon, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your family or friends to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll rebroadcast the Beaver Field Trip with hydrologist Suzanne Foudy that I recorded in Baker County in June. We'll go out with some music by Aaron Neville. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
dead to the core. There's a dragon with matches loose on the town. It takes a whole pail of water just to cool him down. Fire, fire on the mountain. Fire, fire on the mountain. Fire on the mountain. Fire, fire, fire on the mountain. Fire, fire on the mountain.